Welcome back.
Welcome. Oh, welcome back, Lynette.
Yeah.
Yes. Hi. Hi, Monica.
Hi, Faru.
Oh, it's another cool Monday.
It's a hot Monday.
It's a very hot Monday. And we're sitting here and we're just contemplating what we're going to talk about with our next guest, who's a very good guest. I'm very happy, actually.
I'm so excited.
I know she's so excited. I haven't told her that, but I'm so excited I got her to come.
I have been trying to have this guest since the moment we decided to do a podcast.
Me too. But I wouldn't tell her because, you know, I'm trying to keep the whole...
Calm, cool, collected.
Yeah. it's secrecy of an ID, collected ID. You can come if you don't want to. That's fine.
You're excited. I think I should give you the honors of introducing our guest.
Oh, wow. Today. All right. Maybe we'll do some music first.
That sounds like a great idea.
All right. So, guys, this is an amazing episode, man. Hopefully your favorite podcast.
Same time next week.
Okay, guest is here. And again, so excited. So this guest is one of the most experienced art therapists in Egypt.
Or in the region.
If not, yeah, in the whole region.
So, and is the first.
Is the first person. To actually do this.
Yep.
Taught a lot of art therapists now.
Yep.
And is growing this whole community. She's using art therapy to create all sorts of treatments for a lot of illnesses. Wada Hagab is very, very creative, very, very out of the box, and which is very impressive.
So
and
meaningful.
She's an artist as yes, well. Yeah, yes. Best art therapist. She's an artist. She's a great therapist. She's an artist. Carol Hamel. Hi.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm getting a little emotional after hearing all this. This is too much.
Carol, we're so happy to have you today.
Yeah.
I'm really, really excited to chat with you about you and your journey and also art therapy in all its forms. And yeah, I'm really, really excited to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So equally excited. And thank you for the beautiful intro.
I hope it went well. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling great. It's a little hot today. Yeah. It's nice. Summer's here.
Dunya har. احنا كمان لازم نقفل الاي سي for recording.
Yeah, just so you guys know.
So tell me something you've been thinking about today or yesterday.
That's always a tough question.
Yeah, it's a very tough question.
I think...
بس احنا هنسأل نفسنا tough questions برضه.
Yeah.
So that's
okay. هتردوا انتوا كمان تكيد. Thinking about... كتير. Thinking about, you know... What now? Almost 13 years of practice.
Wow.
In this field and how it grew. Mm. Thinking of how proud I am to have... Well, I'm going to name her on that podcast because I'm really proud of her. Nadine Alaysawi, who just graduated with a master's degree in art therapy.
Congratulations, Nadine.
Thank you. She's awesome. She's been my intern for a bit.
Oh.
So we're now five trained art therapists in Egypt.
Wow.
And so I've been thinking a lot about that and how much it grew and how having them finally allows me to practice more of my specialty within art therapy and within counseling.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's a lot of pressure when you're the art therapist for so long.
Yeah, the only one.
Yeah. That was the case for a good at least 7 years or so. The pressure of having to serve the general population. And I work with adults primarily, but it was a lot of responsibility because... This is you being the reference of what art therapy is and the demand and being just one.
Mm.
There's, you know, so many hours in the day that you can in which you can fit clients. And now I finally get to sort of branch out a little bit and do more either supervision work or my favorite area of expertise.
Which is?
Can you guess?
The favorite thing you've experienced in art therapy.
Yeah, of all people, you will like that one. But it's health psychology. And that's, so it's medical art therapy and health psychology.
Wow.
This, I'm so excited to talk about this because I'm sure everyone who's listening is like, how can art therapy serve any sort of purpose in health psychology?
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to bridge this gap for myself and everyone who's listening today.
I'm excited. You're excited.
Yeah.
Very excited.
So like, tell us more about what that looks like.
So, you know, basically, you know, health psychology is a much larger umbrella to therapists who work with medical illness.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, we're not here to work on the medical condition, rather work on the mental aspect with dealing with medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It also entails to be medically informed. So, you know, in the same way that us therapists would be informed about mental illness, in this case, it's also being informed about medical practices, medicine, all sorts of medical conditions, but not for the purpose, again, of addressing them as much as addressing the mental aspect of dealing with medical conditions. And we usually look at them from three perspectives, either mm-hmm. chronic conditions or chronic illness that also involves chronic pain, or degenerative illness or okay. terminal illness.
Mm.
And so I work with all those categories, depending on, you know, the approach is very different from one to the other.
Using art therapy.
Hmm?
Using art therapy.
Using counseling methods in general. And then okay. comes the role of art therapy. And in this case, we call it medical art therapy.
Okay.
So that's, you know, as art therapy typically is, it's really focusing on the expressive bit
uh-huh.
of what you're unable to verbalize. So I would combine both, you know, health psychology, techniques from the counseling aspect
mm-hmm.
and the art therapy aspect, which can be so powerful because you're getting to express, you know, what it means to be a cancer survivor or a pain survivor and what it means to actually deal with all of this, you know, world that few people would know about.
Yeah. And then, Yanni, كان نفسي أسأل because I work with Medicare patients
exactly.
as well and بس مش exclusively mm. بس do you get affected by because sometimes it can be depressing.
Of course. I mean, I've had, you know, my interest grew ever since my very first internship during my master's,
okay,
which was with geriatrics, and it was an outpatient center. It's called the Life Center. It was part of Penn Medicine. And so we had three different floors. We had the end of life section, the locked unit for Alzheimer's and dementia patients. And then we had the low functioning and the high functioning level. And of course, you know, I was already interested a lot in pain management and chronic pain. And there was an element of chronic pain, of course, that was there. And I ended up, you know, because of my interest, I was surprised that there was no pain management over there whatsoever. This was an outpatient mm-hmm. center where typically patients or clients are there from, say, 9, 10 a.m. till 2, 3 p.m. They get picked up with vans. They have breakfast first as a community, and then each one goes to their floor. There's physical therapy, occupational therapy, psychotherapy, recreational therapy, and then they have lunch together. And they leave. And also their doctor's appointments can be seen, can happen there. Mm. So, you know, I was amazed that no one is addressing pain over there. And, uh-huh. you know, I had a huge support as well to actually, they're like, okay, if you're interested, how about you create a program for us? And I did.
For pain?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's how it started. You know, it was addressing pain, but then also working with the end of life, working with dementia, and working with, you know, anyone who was dealing maybe with diabetic pain or shingles or, you know, strokes, they would also have to deal with the aftermath of that. So so to go back to your question, affect me? Yeah, definitely it affects us all. But
yes.
What I really got to learn early on during this internship is how passionate I am about it, how much it makes total sense to me, and how much I really wanted to, you know, do something that is beyond what the book says, you know, what the books say. Because a lot of what we know about art therapy and a lot of what we know about counseling, I always say it's like, toss those books aside, nothing works. You really have to reinvent the wheel when you work with such patients.
Wow.
Yeah.
Would you say that there is like a common desired outcome? Like, for example, like, you know, do you come into each of, I know all these scenarios are so different, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when you're experiencing different types of chronic illness or pain or terminal illness. But is there like a common theme that you want to get out? Is it hope? Is it like just maintaining? Is it just, is it thriving versus just surviving? And what is the desired outcome?
You know, the key word I would say is resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You know, we talk a lot about resilience and trauma, and think of, you know, there is a condition actually called medical PTSD, and that's a fact. A lot of people who go through, especially with chronic illness, you know, when you're there on a regular basis, or something even like cancer, that time from the treatment till the remission, you know, you're very happy to be in remission, but you're also, you know, there's a part of your identity that you've had to deal with for that long. And it's like, how do I cope now? Mm-hmm. How does normal become normal again?
Yeah.
So a big part of the work I do is, you know, A, to achieve resilience, B, finding meaning is a big keyword.
Yeah, that's
uno,
yes. Okay. That's very big. Yeah, that kind of gave it. So Edel, what have you been thinking about for Naharda Umbera, his meaning? And I kalim na andak to you. And especially with terminal illness, that's what we focus on.
There's a lot of existential therapy techniques that I integrate.
Oh, that's
cool. You know, for the psych gurus, the two schools that I use mainly are psychodynamic and existential.
Okay.
Which are absolute
my two faves.
That's amazing.
I love existential. I love it.
Existential is amazing. Huge fan of Irvin Yalom's textbook about, you know, he's the best one who actually wrote about existential therapy so well. It's usually a lot of that, and it's a lot of you just can't do only existential, and there's the psychodynamic component that comes in. Hand, and art therapy is initially founded in psychodynamic theory with. So there's a lot of it that's already an automatic go-to method for me. But psychodynamic alone doesn't do it, especially with health psychology. There's lot of existential themes.
Is it, so, you know, we're talking about making meaning, or and I think resilience a lot of the time includes like having a meaning, or like, or knowing that there's something beyond what you're currently experiencing, and so pushing forward. And that is, would you say a lot of that meaning making has to do with like, who am I outside of this pain or outside of this illness? Or would you say that it has more to do with like making meaning of an incident, like this particular thing in my life?
Both.
Do you know what I mean?
You know, a very common question that someone goes through, that someone asks themselves when this happens, is why me? And if you don't ask why me, it's a general why, and what do I do now? A lot of the times, you know, once you have a diagnosis, a medical diagnosis, you know, that again falls under one of those three categories that we've mentioned, it's a lot of what do I do now? You know, when your life turns upside down, and, you know, we have to focus on treatments, and you have to focus on so much. And there's a lot of, you know, doctors do their best to treat the condition. And even the most humane of doctors will look at symptoms, and that's the treatment course to do. But very, very few would consider, you know, what's the patient going through mentally through that before you even suggest, you know, we're going to do this approach. And I'm not just talking about cancer. I'm talking about anything. Every medication has its long list of side effects. Every intervention, it being surgical or an invasive or non-invasive procedure, has its repercussions. But what does it mean for someone, especially if they don't have a support system? What does it mean to go there, you know, in a very sterile environment and become this vulnerable being? That's what I focus on, you know, to really focus on the struggle. Why fight if I have to fight? You know, if you decide to give up, why are you giving up? And another huge part of also my work, especially more so with terminal illness, it's working with the family. So to kind of liaise between, I'm the voice that's between the medical doctor, the patient, and the family. Very often, so especially in our community, in our society here, there's a lot of push towards, you know, you got to take this medicine, you got to take this intervention. We want you to push through, and
no respect to the patient's choice.
You want to know what the patient really wants to do. You know, one very popular example that I use a lot when dealing with, you know, a family that's trying to help, you know, a patient. I once had a patient who was going through, you know, a really ugly bout of cancer. And her request was like, they're pushing me so hard to do this and do that because they want to stimulate me and they want me to, you know, to be active and go around. And the whole debate was about her morning coffee. So she likes to have her coffee in the morning. So ideally, she wants to go walk to the kitchen, get her coffee done, go back to bed, and enjoy it. And because of her physical condition, this was a little tricky because she was a fall risk. Mm-hmm. And so her family automatically are all about, we're going to get you the coffee to your bed. Just wait there.
Yeah.
And there's this, you know, fighting back and forth. I want to get my coffee. And so the compromise that I usually suggest in a, you know, situation like that is like, bring her the water and the coffee and the sugar in the tray. And let her make her coffee. Own
yeah.
coffee
yeah.
because there's an element of self-control here that, yes. that you need to have.
Yes.
So for her, you serving me my coffee, A, I'm gonna get upset, it's a little too sweet, it's not the same temperature that I want. And when you're that ill, you hold on so badly to those little things.
The autonomy of those little things.
Exactly. Yes. It yeah. makes me. Choice, it makes yeah. it's yeah. a sense of normalcy. It
provides a lot of
that
meaning.
I want to keep.
Yeah. yeah. It provides a lot of meaning. I had a patient when I was in the UK who was a stage 4 terminal cancer. Lung cancer spread all over. It was terminal. And all the doctors were trying to force her to take this new treatment that just has a very 0.01 increase in chance of survival.
Yeah.
But it has a lot of side effects. And she tried it once and she couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
And all her family was trying to push her into, because the family are scared.
Of course.
And doctors called me to kind of revoke her capacity.
Yeah.
To say that she doesn't have capacity.
And therefore they
to
decide.
To make that yeah. choice. And therefore they can actually
wow.
give her the treatment. And I mean, when I sat with her, she was like, I'm done with medicine. I want to live my last 2-3 months in doing herbal medicine and going to like traveling to a place where I go and meditate and find out more about the meaning of life. And that's what she wanted to do before death. Because she said, I'm going to die anyway. Might as well do something out of my life.
Absolutely.
I wanted to have meaning. And that's when I told them she has absolute capacity to make that choice.
Yeah.
Because there aren't any mental illnesses. This is humanity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the whole concept of palliative care in Egypt still, you know, we're really far away from it, the whole concept of it. But I really hope that it's something that I know at least a few doctors have worked with closely that, you know, do believe in it and see the importance of it.
Yeah.
If that's medically, you know, there's nothing we could do.
Yeah.
The whole idea of making the patient comfortable, you know, something that we have so much to learn about.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not just about like incredible bedside manner. It is recognizing that this is a whole other organism that's happening. It's like the emotional experience of what's going through in the physical body is a parallel life that's happening that is just like completely thrown away when someone is going through a physical illness, which is so unusual.
Yeah.
Because they're so intertwined.
Yeah. In Egypt, the whole boundary between we want to protect someone and letting them make their own choices is very blurry.
I mean, boundaries in this region in general. Blurry.
Blurry.
Totally.
Yeah. yeah.
But
there's so much to learn about that, I believe. And, you know, I also get it, you know, as a doctor, you're doing your job. You know that this is something that I need to, I mean, you would get that more than I do. But, you know, the idea of, this will work and we need to do this to help you. But it's really also, you know, what does the patient want? Another thing that is huge also in the part of the work that I do is psychoeducate them and medically educate them. There's so much in our, you know, many doctors will be you're fine.
No breaking bad news, Khalis.
Yeah, yes. We don't explain how the condition is. We don't explain how the medication works.
What an intervention.
We automatically assume that I know best and you're going to follow what I say.
Yeah.
That's a huge part also of what I get to do, to explain to my clients. You know, I always ask them what medications you're on. And do you know how this medication works and how it affects you?
Yes.
And if they're interested and they want to know more, I get to tell them how it works. Everything from neuroscience-based to, you know, physically, how it affects us.
Yeah.
Same applies for a medical condition. Like, are you aware of that, what that is?
That's so powerful to me. I mean, it's so important. If people had shared, you know, even personally, I'm thinking if people had told me if I had been, you know, given the information about like how a particular medication was going to affect me, then I could also like safeguard myself in a lot of ways, not just emotionally, but I could like, if I knew my joints were going to become weaker, then mm-hmm. I would have like strengthened my back, and I would have done, you know, there are things that you can do to also maneuver and navigate symptoms in a Absolutely. Lot of ways when you have that kind of information and you're able to process in your own time these different experiences. This is like, that's so powerful to be able to have that.
Totally, totally. You just reminded me, you know, literally yesterday I was getting an ultrasound over my hands. I've been complaining of a lot of hand pain, and it has to do with my joints as well. And, you know, the health psychology expert in me and or specialist in me, I'm looking at the screen. I was like, this is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I never heard anyone tell me this before. And I was like, well, nerdy me, of course, I'm going to find this interesting. But, you know, and then I can see that he's sort of like pointing at where the effusion is and where the joints are. And then he asked me what I did. So I explained. So he obviously knows I'm medically informed. Mm-hmm. And still the whole time, he's like, I was like, okay, the verdict. He's like, la, la, t'es bien, ça tombe bien, il me fiche mon chèque.
Yes.
But then I see the effusion, it's there. I see the inflammation.
He just told you.
And he's like literally writing on the, you know, on the pad. And like, yeah, there is inflammation, but it's okay. Tombe bien, il y en a tombe bien, mais t'es lèche. And I was like, ma fiche mushkila, mish mahtak ta tomini. It can be whatever it is. You can just let me know what it is.
Yeah.
But there's this inherent part in the medical system here that atomin al morid. Yeah. You want to reassure them for sure, but you also want to tell them that, you know, there's a reason for this pain. You know, one of the things I often see with a lot of my clients is the frustration of, you know, them dealing with pain and being told, nothing's wrong with you, you're fine.
Oh, yes.
And it's like everyone will criticize me for being upset and frustrated because don't you want to have good news? And they're like, yeah, but I'm in pain, so there's a reason for this pain.
Yeah. Yes.
Or
yes.
I'm not well, so there's a reason why I'm unwell. Yeah. And so I want that diagnosis.
There's so much affirmation in diagnosis.
Totally.
This is like, oh, yeah, and then there's so much education in diagnosis and it's just to be told, yes, you are not insane. Like, this is real. Is in and of itself to me so healing and liberating.
I find it very difficult. So when we're talking about pain, خاصةً the pain you're talking about, pain اللي هو ما فيش حاجة, ما فيش pain, ما فيش سبب. So that brings to my mind fibromyalgia, MSM, for example. And I find it, and I know you're such an expert on that. So we'll talk more about that. But I find that it's actually so pressuring explaining to the family that there is a condition that's actually causing all these very strange symptoms without حاجة تطلع في تحليل أو حاجة تطلع في حاجة. And actually, I find it sometimes more difficult to convince the patients or the clients that you actually have something that's causing, because most of my fibro clients are usually very tough on themselves. So they would go like, أنا ما عنديش حاجة, ما فيش حاجة بتوجعني, أنا مش فاهم لي, أنا مش كويس, أنا مفروض أبقى أحسن. And that's very, very difficult. But please tell me what you know. Tell me your experience with fibro.
Maybe first let's talk about what is fibro, just for people who don't know who are listening.
Yeah.
Well, fibromyalgia is a very unique condition. Before we explain fibromyalgia, let's say something about pain.
Yeah.
Pain is a signal from the brain to start with. But what we've known in medicine for so long is that pain is a signal from the brain indicating something is wrong. And most of the time, it's either inflammatory pain. So there's an issue with your joints or your back, or there's a disc, or you've had surgery. So it's the pain from the incision or whatnot. So there's always either trauma, like physical trauma, or inflammation. Comes fibromyalgia, which defies all of that. It's still a pain signal, but there's nothing in your body to indicate that anything is inflamed or traumatized, or it's just a signal. It's a faulty signal in the brain. And that's why, you know, a lot of the literature was, you know, classifying it as a CNS disorder or central nervous system. Because the, you know, that terrible comment of it's all in your head. Well, it literally is in your head. It is stemming from the brain primarily. And basically what it is, it's a pain disorder where there's two theories to explain it. One is an overactivity of pain neurotransmitters, so the part of your brain that is responsible for emitting those pain signals. Another theory is that, again, the faulty signal part of this faulty emission of pain signals from the certain central nervous system. And what the patient experiences, so that's the dirty part of, you know, our talk, but for a patient, that's basically widespread pain.
Yeah.
Oftentimes around areas where joints would be, but there's nothing wrong with your joints. A huge debate, is it nerve pain? Is it muscle pain? It's kind of both.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another huge part of fibromyalgia as well is something called the alpha wave anomaly during sleep. And that means that, you know, when we're asleep, our brain emits certain waves, the sleep waves when we're asleep. People with fibromyalgia have bouts of alpha waves, which is the awake waves.
Okay.
And what this does is that you almost never enter into REM sleep. That's the part of, that's the part responsible for dreams. It's the part responsible for your body to fully shut down, to get to restore, you know, your organs and your body and your breathing and all. And so a lot of people with fibromyalgia don't have restorative sleep. That also contributes to how your muscles are.
Of course.
Because when you're sleeping, your entire body is relaxing. People with fibromyalgia don't necessarily relax enough during sleep. So you wake up with that ache. And a lot of rheumatic conditions automatically have the symptom of morning stiffness. So they think it's morning stiffness, but it really isn't. And so you wake up with that ache, you know, every morning for at least a couple of hours, similar to morning stiffness, but that's because your muscles are already, you know, at their max stretch. And so needless to say, with any minimal effort, you're going to feel the pain. If you're playing sports, it's going to hurt. If you're going to bend over and carry something, it's going to hurt more. So, you know, we look at fibromyalgia as what we would call a systemic condition. Not, and by the way, it's not an autoimmune disorder, as many think it might be. But it's not, it's systemic, and systemic means it affects different parts of the body.
Okay.
So the sleep bit, there's the pain bit. For a lot of people, there's also a depression comorbidity, meaning a lot of people might have depressive episodes. And frankly speaking, to think of living with pain on such a daily basis, it's only understandable that it might at least cause depressive episodes even now.
And not being able to do, not feeling like you're unable to do anything to change that experience.
There's also the brain fog, the reduced concentration.
Which many people are familiar with now post-COVID.
Yes.
So it's very similar to it. It's that sort of inability. The way I describe it is, you know, your memory is blocking an entire series of events.
Yes.
So, you know, say you've been told, "Hi, Monica, we're going to meet over dinner in 3 days at 8. And what you forget is this, is me telling you today that we're going to meet at 8. And so whatever happens after is just gone. And comes 3 days later, you totally forgot that exact moment. And so you have that forgetfulness in that sense. The fog, which may affect concentration levels, of course, all responsible behind that is the sleep issue as well.
It's so difficult to experience.
It can be. And what's more frustrating is, you know, besides all those symptoms, is being told nothing is wrong with you. Because, of course, what we know of pain is we're going to do a bunch of MRIs, maybe a bunch of, you know, blood tests.
Rheumatoid fat,
we're going to rule out autoimmune disease.
Is it lupus? Is it not lupus? Yes.
First line of, you know, diagnosis is rule out rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and all the autoimmune rheumatic conditions. None of those. You know, you didn't necessarily suffer a trauma or anything. You don't have a disc in your back. Nothing's wrong with you. You know, and a huge part of diagnosis in medicine is by elimination process. So it's literally eliminating everything else until.
Which is a big problem. It takes
such
a while
exhausting
to get that diagnosis. It takes a long while because you'll get that, like, very person, like a smart rheumatologist who says, "Oh, this is an atypical rheumatoid arthritis," or something like that, and then go into a whole lot of corticosteroids, which does nothing to fibro, and then a lot of other immunosuppressants, and they will use everything. And
is that, does that include cortisone?
That's what it is.
Egypt loves cortisone.
Everyone loves
I mean, like, it's like, we don't know what this is, let's throw cortisone.
That's what they do abroad as well. But this is like the process of actually ان الواحد يوصل ان هو عنده فايبرو بياخد وقت كتير قوي. وبعد كده you have to fight on daily basis explaining to people around you, عشان في دكاتره كتير قوي بيكوميونيكيت ان فايبرو ده نفسيه. ده سايكولوجي, ما تضغطش عليها مثلا شويه. انا مسينج عليها because it's more common in females. بس اللي هم ما it's a classic example, ما تضغطش عليها, سيبها, مش عارف ايه, ما تعملش مش عارف ايه, and there is a lot of pain. And what I found most interesting is behind that pain, there are two things, and correct me if I'm wrong, tell me if that's your experience. There is a lot of unexpressed feelings and thoughts. That's one thing. And the other thing is there's a lot, the pain causes a lot of avoidance. So people avoid a lot of stuff. People with fibro بيحبوا يقعدوا في البيت او في السرير اكتر, عشان اي حاجه زي ما انت تقولي, لو انا وطيت جبت حاجه من الارض very painful. رحت لعبت تنس extremely painful. رحت swimming extremely painful. And the doctors will tell you part of treating fibro is actually going to swimming and going to the gym. And then it's like, ازاي اروح للحاجه اللي بتوجعني وده هيساعدني في التريتمنت. فthere's a lot of avoidance, there's a lot of withdrawal. And once you withdraw, once it gets that, it then deteriorates. بس قولي لي, what do you think?
I mean, it's this huge debate of, yeah, movement helps with fibromyalgia and many other rheumatic conditions as well. But I can't move because it hurts is, you know, the other, you know, side of that story. So how much do I move and what kind of movement? What kind of exercise? I mean, we always say, okay, low impact exercise. So we always say that water, you know, exercise is the best. So if swimming or just even walking in a pool, walking is another option. Some, you know, and the other thing, as in typical chronic conditions, every patient is different. Every person is different. You know, some might be really active and able to be, you know, out and about and here and there and, and playing sports. And once they have their flare-ups, and that's another thing about fibromyalgia and many rheumatic conditions, flare-ups. So, you know, a patient lives with this chronic pain, and then they get those episodes, or we call them flare-ups.
When it just gets so bad.
Exactly. And that's when you just have to, you know, ride it out and, you know, lie down. The debate of, like, heat or cold therapy, you know, some would rather have the heat because it really, you know, stimulates circulation, and some would rather do cold to actually numb the nerves a little bit. So there's no like right way to do things, as much as it's just the right way for you. And it involves a lot of experimenting, and that usually is part of the work I do as well, to really help them experiment with what really helps, until they figure out, you know, the best remedy approach.
Tell us more about that, like in your approach, maybe also in like how art therapy has a role kind of in helping people who are living with fibro or other chronic illnesses.
So one of the things I love to do is what we call a visual journal. So, you know, same idea as having a diary or a journal. Instead of writing, it's just doing a sketch on a daily basis. And art can be a wonderful monitor for what you're going through, not only expressing pain. And here's the thing, you know, how do we express pain? We say, ouch, or I'll come and tell you I'm in pain, but you don't understand what I tell you I'm in pain. If you don't know pain, you're not going to understand what that entails. Art does that. It shows you, you know, the amount of pain you're in. If, you know, if you're dealing with some hand pain or arm pain or anything, that's also going to affect your art quality. And that's another indicator as well for me and for the client. To get to have that. And then on the other side of that is to have an outlet, to have an expressive outlet, to have something that knows, you know, what this means, and to see, you know, how my pain gets to have, you know, a page, literally. I also recommend a lot of pain monitoring apps, which now we have thanks to technology. And usually I have them like put a rating on the page in the visual journal of, you know, what's your pain level, the classic 0 to 10, which sometimes doesn't make any sense to some people. you know, and you don't really know how to classify my pain. It's just, it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to have that expressive bit. It's really very helpful as well.
It's cool to be able to have like something as well, like a physical thing, especially for something that's so immaterial. Like it's a pain that you can't hold on to it.
Exactly.
It's cool to have something that's material that says, this is what it is. This is what I'm feeling.
You know, and you reminded me of an intervention that I did back to the center where I used to work. And so I had a group of maybe 10, 12 participants. And so we created a pain survivors mural.
Wow.
And that was a combination of, you know, collage and paint and writing. And they actually hung it, you know, they framed it and hung it at the center. And there's a lot of empowerment. And that's another key word besides the resilience, you know, to be empowered by your unique experience of, you know, dealing with all this, but still doing what you do best. You know, one of the biggest fear, I would say, to any chronic illness, and especially with pain, it's your fear of being unable to do what you do. So
yes,
I don't know, if I'm a parent and I have to raise kids, then am I going to be able to do that?
Yes.
And pain,
yes,
not interfering, that happens with a lot of my clients.
Yeah.
If it's my job, if it's taking care of someone, if it's traveling, whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
So also working a lot on the mental aspect of,
yeah,
reaching the balance. I think another key word here is always balance, to be, yeah, able to know when to just slow down and to pace yourself, and when to use the times when you're better and achieve what you can.
Yeah. And one part I love about, so we kind of work parallel of you doing the art therapy, yeah, and I use the acceptance and commitment, which really kind of, It's sort of different, but it's very similar. But I'm now thinking about them, my clients, how would they benefit from art therapy? And I found a lot of my clients would benefit from art therapy. بس الحاجة اللي كنت بقى اللي بتعلمها وبقراها كتير في acceptance and commitment is trying to live parallel to the pain.
Yeah.
So that's true. The most important thing is identifying your values, see what your life is all about, and maybe try to live parallel to the thing that's telling you don't do anything.
Totally.
And a lot of people, when they focus on life, the pain doesn't go away.
Yeah.
And that's the scary part for,
yeah,
me. It doesn't. It doesn't get better, but it's less focused upon.
Totally. It's, again, it brings us back to finding meaning. And,
yes,
you know, it becomes, it's there and it's present and it's part of who you are. It doesn't have to define you. There's a lot of debate about, you know, my illness doesn't define me.
Yeah.
But my illness and my pain is part of who I am.
Yes,
as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes,
and I can't deny that. And
yeah,
part of my work is also help them embrace that.
Yep.
But also define it in the sense, and find meaning to it in the sense of, as you said, you know, having a parallel line of doing what you do best. And that's a great self-esteem booster. Pain is a self-esteem plummeter. I mean, it just, it takes you down all the way.
In a second.
Yeah.
In a second. It really humbles you. Yeah. And I had a very minor, mild, I'm just going to call it moderate because it was bad pain. It's not mild, but I was just humbled for 3 days straight.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what people with fiber go through.
Mm.
Yeah. Wow. Mm. This has been great.
Yeah.
This has been great.
I hope we got to still instill some hope.
Yeah.
I know a lot of the talk can be a little intense, but
I think so. I think even knowing that there are practical avenues that we can take, or people can take, when experiencing something that's often unexplainable and unspeakable, literally, like in terms of verbal communication. I think that's like filled with hope.
Yeah. And I just want to explain, because I said the pain doesn't go away. Sometimes it does reduce. Mm-hmm. But the fact that when you're not focusing just on the pain, the whole kind of space that you can create between you and the pain, kind of that makes all
the difference.
Yeah.
I think one thing I always want to make sure to tell everyone is you can have a full life with whatever condition that you're dealing with.
Yeah. Mm.
And I'm not here to spread the whole idea of mind over matter, though that's proven, you know, at this point, but it's really about finding your own balance.
Mm. Yeah.
There are ways, you know, through psychotherapy and art therapy, through proper medical interventions, through your own education and self-awareness, there are ways to live a full life with it being fibromyalgia, it being a chronic condition, it being any form of illness.
Yeah.
Just, you need to understand it so well And you need to understand yourself so well.
Yes.
To know how these two can integrate and become one without one fighting the other.
Yes.
For sure. And that's part of the work that I get to do and help people achieve.
Wow. This is fantastic. Yeah.
Carol, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you guys
in. And
also for being so interested of, in, you yeah, know, in such a topic. We rarely get to talk about it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. It's been really great.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure. Let's make some art.
Yeah.
Let's make some art. Yes, that'd be awesome. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
Let's do that.
Cool.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. And thank you, Carol, again for such amazing insights into terminal illness and chronic illness and fibromyalgia and pain and art therapy. And yeah, Monica.
Until next time.
Till next time with your maybe, hopefully, favorite podcast.
Same time next week.
Let's do this.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
O7 Therapy is a digital platform that provides mental health solutions for Arabic speakers around the globe. Download the mobile app today and start your wellness journey.